Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in about 10 minutes, we'll hear from Andrew Ross, professor of American Studies at NYU, about the Occupy student debt campaign. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Phil Matera, research director with Good Jobs First, about all those economic development subsidies that states give out. How much money is involved, and do they work? Before that, indulge me a moment's reporting from my own backyard, though this probably has broader relevance since my backyard is one of the world capitals of neoliberalism. The New York City Independent Budget Office is just out with an analysis of income distribution in the city. It's no surprise that it's very unequal. The surprise is that it's more unequal than Brazil's. Some highlights. The poorest tenth of the city's population has an average income of $988 and claim 0.1% of the city's total income. Since the source of this data is tax returns, the very poor no doubt have hidden sources of income. Taxable income doesn't include many social benefits like public housing or food stamps, so their actual income is probably higher than that. But even so, my God. The bottom half of the city's income distribution has 9% of total income. The bottom 80%, 29%. Those are far smaller shares than the U.S. average. But here's where the real action is, the proverbial 1%. It has a third of all the city's income. Nationally, the 1% has about a fifth. Radio isn't the place for an extended string of numbers, so if you're interested, visit my blog at lbo-news.com, lbo-news.com, for the details. You're probably tired of Christopher Hitchens' obits by now, so I'll keep this one short. I didn't know him well, but I did know him, and I was very fond of him personally. He wrote a lot of wonderful things before his turn to the bellicose right after 9/11, and many awful things afterwards, but to me and many others who knew him, he remained a warm and gracious person. That doesn't excuse his apologetics for imperialist war, but it does complicate them. He once said, back in the good old days, rejecting the ubiquitous and facile equivalents of Stalin and Hitler, that with Stalin one at least got the feeling that he was betraying something. I feel that way about Christopher Hitchens. His often vicious bleatings on behalf of Bush and his wars were a betrayal of his better former self. It was, as the very smart British Trotskyist Alex Kalinicko said, a sorry end for someone who at his best could articulate much nobler aspirations. Here's some of an interview I did in his show when Hitchens published his book on Orwell back in 2002. Political taxonomists have had a difficult time with Orwell. People on the left have embraced him and rejected him. People on the right have tried to claim him as one of their own. Is this enterprise at all valuable, and where do you come in on the subject?
Well, I've sort of changed my mind about this since I wrote the book. I mean, I'm convinced that the neoconservatives who claim him are wrong, for example, that they say he was so anti-communist that he would have supported them in Vietnam, even though he was also very anti-colonialist. In my book, I say he was so root and branch anti-colonialist that he would have seen the origins of the Vietnam War and would have rejected them with contempt. He wouldn't have joined the neocons. But let's suppose I'm wrong. Suppose he had. I'd far rather argue with him and with his mind and with his way of thinking than I would with Norman Podhoretz, with whom there's nothing to argue about. Squabbling over the corpse isn't that important. In his lifetime, he withstood every temptation to leave the ranks of the socialist left and distinguished himself within those ranks as a great egalitarian, as a great investigator of poverty and its causes, as a great denouncer of imperialism, as a great volunteer fighter against fascism. And we know that he had the chance to move to the right because it was always being offered to him. He never took it, but maybe he would have done. Nonetheless, I'd rather have argued with him than with the people who claim him, and I'd certainly rather argue with him than with the people who said that by criticizing Stalin, he let down the left, because if they want to identify Stalin with the left, that's their problem, isn't it, not mine.
Nor mine. Let's now bring this up to date, because there's certainly a lot of Orwellian aspects of the present that I think bear some investigation. You don't really talk much in the book about one of the things that people think of when they hear the word Orwellian, which is that heavens, East Asia is not our enemy, East Asia is our friend. The shifting alliances in the state of perpetual war and the lies at circum. I mean, we were back in the day when Saddam Hussein was doing the work of the United States in hanging communists. We remember the days when the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were doing our work in fighting the Soviet Union. And now these people are our enemies. Does this course of events disturb you at all?
Well, it both disturbs and amuses me, because, like you, I remember it I remember it actually in very much the same terms that you do. In fact, in the book, if I can say a word for it, I cite at length Orwell's attack on James Burnham, who was the great founder of, you know, the idea of the American Imperium, and the great left defector who became the supporter of American Empire. And Orwell wrote two very long and detailed and, I think, very clever exposés of him, showing that what his real problem was the worship of power. In the case that you just mentioned, obviously the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which Orwell wrote about and I also mentioned, is the greatest change of allegiance, you know, there's ever been, and from both sides. And only a very few people were ready for it and said, don't let's just satirize this, let's oppose it. It's not just let's score points about, you know, who switched sides, but let's say, well, if there's a Hitler-Stalin Pact, then you really do have all your enemies in one place. By the way, I'll add one thing. The term Cold War is coined by Orwell. He's the first person to use the term, and it's in an essay, which again I cite, which says there are two dangers about the current situation of the nuclear post-war. One is the danger of nuclear extermination, which is obvious, but not many people actually were worried about it at the time. And second, he said, the danger is of permanent superpowers with nuclear weapons who can keep redefining their enemies and keep redefining the quarrel, but who in fact have more in common with each other than they do with anyone else, and whose rule would become absolute because they were nuclear elite and impervious to democratic process. So I think these thoughts must be alive all the time in everyone's mind.
Well, now we have only one superpower that is presuming to dictate to the rest of the world what to do.
Well, only one that can do it globally. But given the size, say, of North Korea, and the relative weight of North Korea in the world economy, which is in fact nil, it means its own people are starving to death, but it's willing to put all its money into uranium rods. North Korea can certainly destroy the capital of South Korea on day one of any conflict, which would be a big consideration for those of us who cared about things like that, not for those who didn't. That being the element of blackmail. And probably can threaten Japan. That's quite a lot with a small nuclear capacity. And it does show a point that Orwell kept on making. If you have a totally regimented, totalitarian, dictatorial state, it's unlikely to keep it to that. It probably has ambitions beyond its own borders. And with both Mr. Saddam and Mr. Kim Jong-il, I've been to both of their countries, it's quite remarkable to see how they appear to have modeled their state on Orwell. And thus, I think the relevance of his writing on this is very fresh and very immediate.
Just one more question, though. You told my friend Jeet Heer of the Canadian National Post that you were thinking about a non-imperial occupation of Iraq. Wondering what that means, and do you think Orwell would have approved of such a phrase?
We are back in Orwell territory, all right, because you do need, just as one needs a word for anti-Americanism, I feel there is such a thing as anti-Americanism, but anti-Americanism is an inadequate word for it. It's a word that's been discredited by repetition and overuse and propaganda and so on. There should be a word, though, for those who dislike everything America does on principle in advance. I'll come up with one, I hope, one day. In the same way, there are people in Washington now who openly say, why don't we just say we're imperialists? Let's say it's the American Empire. Let's just move into other countries and let's just do it. Whereas there are those who say, you know, we might have to inherit responsibility of certain countries with reluctance, but because there's no alternative. Well, now, there ought to be a discourse where there are terms that separate those two ambitions and those two impulses. And I must say, I'm glad to know that highly intelligent guy is a friend of yours, and I think all three of us should be trying to think of ways of doing so. Humanitarian interventionism, as defined by Blair, is a bit sickly and a bit hypocritical, and it can be referred to sarcastically. But we do all know from experience, from Haiti to Bosnia to Rwanda, which was a case of non-intervention, right? Rwandans suffered because there wasn't an empire to help them. Sierra Leone and so forth. You know the rest of the example. We do know of the vast territory that exists between isolationism and imperialism. And we are going to be very interested in how to do it and how to talk about it. And yes, I wish there was an Orwell to help us define those terms.
Oh, some of Christopher Hitchens from an interview I did with him on this show back in 2002 about his book Why Orwell Matters. He didn't do a very good job of explaining what a non-imperial occupation was. I'm sorry this is how he spent much of the last 10 years of his life, because there was much to admire in what went before. Back after a musical break. That was a bit of the first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14 in C-sharp minor, a passage that Richard Wagner called the most melancholy in all of music. Hyperbolic, perhaps, and based on a rather narrow canon, but there's something to the claim. That, in memory of the Hitchens who died a few days ago, and the better Hitchens who died a decade ago. It's also in honor of Beethoven's birthday, which is presumed to be December 16th. We don't know for sure, but that's our best guess. Regular listeners probably know that I'm rather fond of old Ludwig, and we'll hear more of his music later in the show. My first guest is Andrew Ross. Andrew is a professor of American Studies at NYU and one of the organizers of the Occupy Student Debt campaign. Student debt in the U.S. is approaching $1 trillion, an enormous dead weight around the necks of scores of millions of mostly, though far from all, young people. Its growth is a consequence of deliberate policy choices starting in the 1970s to make higher education more expensive and less accessible. The original impetus, as Bruce Franklin points out in an excellent little talk he gave at the Modern Language Association in 2000, was to repress the demands for opening up the university to the working class that came from radicalized students at two once free universities, the University of California and the City University of New York. The rationale is captured in a memorable and famous comment by Roger Freeman, an education advisor to Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon, who said this in 1970, "We are in danger of producing an educated proletariat. That's dynamite. We have to be selective on who we allow to go through higher education." Reagan ended the free ride at Cal in 1970, and 6 years later, the unelected banker king of New York, Felix Roatan, ended it at CUNY. From there, the elite shifted its attention to mass incarceration, a much more pleasing approach to the proletariat in its eyes than free education. There are some shallow pseudo-radicals who dismiss calls for free higher ed as, and I'm quoting someone I debated with just a few months ago, the equivalent of a reading room in a prison. Leaving aside the facts that Malcolm X educated himself in a prison library and that the right wants to shut down prison libraries too, that educated proletariat problem again, that line is utter nonsense. The bourgeoisie understands what it's doing by making college expensive. Having a lot of debt when you graduate limits your career choices to the safest options, if you're lucky enough to find a job at all. Okay, with all that in mind, here's Andrew Ross. Welcome, Andrew. First, before we talk about the details of the campaign, give us some idea of the dimensions of the student debt problem. How pervasive? How much?
Well, actually, in terms of volume, the dollar amount of student debt in this country is about to pass the $1 trillion mark, and there'll be a lot of champagne glasses being raised in the lending industry when that happens. Just this last year, the same glasses were being raised when cumulative student debt surpassed consumer debt in this country, which is just a kind of staggering amount of money to consider.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, people, Wall Street people follow the monthly releases on consumer debt very, very closely, for a lot of people in society, unless they're having to pay the bills, student debt doesn't really enter their consciousness very much.
It doesn't. And to be quite frank, it didn't really register that high in my consciousness until the last few years or so. I think for university teachers like myself, there's a wall of denial around this topic. I think we've always known that our salaries in part do depend on our students going into debt bondage for decades to come, but we chose not to dwell on it, as with so many other things. But in the last few years, it's become almost impossible to ignore or deny. And I mean, speaking for myself, it's one of the reasons why I got more involved in the student debt issue and started working on a campaign designed really to highlight it. But that denial is certainly out there, and in the higher education landscape, which is entirely dependent and increasingly dependent on student debt, you'll find a similar story in many corners of that landscape.
There's a perception out there that NYU students are a bunch of spoiled rich kids. I guess that's not really true.
NYU actually has the highest average student debt per capita in graduation. It's about 40% above the national average, and certainly there's a real problem there, as there is in many high-end private universities that have very small endowments. NYU fits that bill. That said, the status of these kinds of students is often chosen as typical, kind of typical profile of the student debtor, when in fact they're fairly atypical in a sense. Most student debtors are in their 30s or 40s. Many of them are gray hair. We're not just talking about the most indebted generation in history. We're talking about at least two indebted generations. And as you know, higher education is a mass system in this country. And if you go down to the 2-year colleges, and you're going to find working class families sustaining a considerable amount of debt just to push their sons and daughters into, the lowest rungs of the higher education ladder. So it's a very uneven landscape. And while some of the largest debts are sustained in high-end private universities, the entire system is increasingly being run on student debt.
How does the system work? Who extends the loans? Who are the creditors ultimately?
Well, up until recently, the federal government actually subsidized a lot of the loans from the private sector, from private lenders. All federal loans now are supposed to originate with the government itself, but the number of private loans is still considerable, and the rate at which loans from private lenders are made is increasing much faster than the federal rate. And if that trend continues, then in 10, 15 years' time, the estimate is that loans from the private sector will have surpassed the number of federal loans. So it's certainly true that federal loans originate now with the government, but that hasn't been the case in the past, and that may not be entirely the case in the future. That said, the federal loans continue to be offered at rates of interest that seem to me and others to be pretty extortionate. 6, 7, 8% far above mortgage equity loan rates, and considerably above the rate at which the government borrows money. The rates are much higher in the private sector, but even the federal loans seem to be extortionately high. And given that student debtors alone of all debtors cannot declare bankruptcy and virtually have no consumer protections whatsoever, they're basically predatory loans.
And with the student debt, the federal government can actually go after your Social Security check if you're not lucky enough to have paid off your loan by the time you retire. Isn't that right?
Yes. Creditors have extraordinary powers of extraction. All of the power and rights are on the creditor's side, and absolutely none are on the debtor's side. And this is a kind of extraordinary situation, and it just accentuates how unjust the system really is. Thinking about it in a broader sense, our government tells us that everyone has to have a degree these days to get a shot at any kind of decent livelihood in the knowledge economy or any other kind of economy. And so basically you have to go into debt in order to labor. That's that's the contract that we've set up for our knowledge economy. And that kind of equation correlates basically to indenture. I mean, it's a very strong word to use, but I think it's kind of applicable. If you have to go into debt in order to labor, then that's the system of indenture. And in the case of graduates, of course, they're looking at chronic unemployment right now, so the labor isn't even there, and the worst may yet be to come.
Now, you mentioned high-end private universities like NYU with small endowments. The Ivies have fairly large endowments and often can offer generous aid packages, but a place like NYU really can't do that. But also the public universities now have gotten more and more expensive. I mean, this is not just a private university problem, is it?
No, not at all. And actually, in the campaign that we've launched, which is called Occupy Student Debt Campaign, one of the major principles that the campaign is based on is the need to restore free public education. The single biggest step you could take in alleviating student debt would be to restore tuition-free public education, which of course existed in states like New York or California. And with the GI Bill, which provided a free public education for tens of millions of Americans, we have that history in the not-so-recent past, and other countries around the world, all of them less affluent than the U.S., seem to manage to provide tuition-free public education. And our estimate is that it would cost not much more than $70 billion for the federal government to cover the tuition costs at all 2- and 4-year colleges in this country, which is, a relatively small slice of the federal budget, and you could pick other $70 billion items that are entirely dubious by comparison to measure that against.
I think that's about 1 month of Pentagon spending, to pick one just at random. I'm speaking with Andrew Ross, a professor at American Studies at NYU. Just one more couple more questions before we get to the campaign itself. It's not just traditional universities that are the problem. It's also some of these for-profit academies and trade schools, which are essentially diploma mills, right?
Yeah, in a way, they're really the worst offenders, and they're very well politically connected. I mean, they're lobbyists. Mentioned Dick Gephardt and others who have cycled out of government and gone into lobbying for the for-profit university sector. They have a lot of friends in Capitol Hill, and they organize their interests very, very well. Some of the worst and most venal situations for students in this country are at these for-profit universities. They have a very low graduation rate, and so you have a high percentage of students who build up this debt and don't even have anything to show for it at the end of their tenure in higher education.
It seems, just anecdotally, I'm not sure there's any rigorous evidence about this, but anecdotally it seems that a very large share of the participants in Occupy movements around the country have been driven there by the combination of unemployment and student debt. You think that's a correct perception?
I agree, and indeed, the student debt has been a constant refrain at Occupy locations and on Occupy websites, and it's certainly one of the most visibly advertised features of the general focus on debt, which is, as you know, a primary theme running through all the Occupy activities. And we noticed that fairly early on, and decided that there might be some action initiative that would come out of this that would sort of draw out some of the Occupy activity into a national action initiative, which is why we decided to launch this campaign.
Although Wall Street can seem very abstract to people at times, when you talk about things like this, student debt, but also foreclosure, which is another lively issue around the Occupy movements, this really brings Wall Street and the reality of financial servitude home to a lot of people.
Yeah, it does, and the stories are harrowing. There's a lot of testimonies about student debtors suffering the agony and the humiliation of debt in personal isolation, because that isn't something that is something that's shameful to speak about, and so people don't do it, and they suffer in personal isolation, and all sorts of consequences follow from that: depression, divorce, suicide, and so on and so forth. We've heard a lot of these stories in the last few years or so, and that's what's particularly harrowing about it. It's this a combination of shame and moralism that surrounds debt that is particularly debilitating.
I want to return to that topic in a moment, but now tell us about the campaign. What's it all about?
Well, the campaign comes out of the Occupy process. Members of a working group, Education and Empowerment Working Group at Occupy Wall Street, we got together and we decided to frame this campaign as a way for debtors to have an alternative to doing this in personal isolation, as I said, and to be able to act publicly and collectively. And it centers around the pledge of refusal. Debtors sign the pledge and pledge to withhold their loan payments after a million others have signed up. And it's also tied to four basic principles, one of them being about free public education, another being that student loans should be interest-free because we don't consider student loans to be consumer loans. Paying for an education is not like paying for a flat-screen TV. We also think that private universities should open their books, and also that the current debt burden should be written off. So these are the four principles. They're not demands, because we do respect the no demands ethos of Occupy. But they're principles that support this action initiative. I guess we see it justified by the opportunity for debtors to empower themselves by taking this public act, as it were.
And the million pledges is a way of dealing with the fact that no one wants to be alone stepping into this uncertain territory.
No, it's basically a debt strike threat. See, so far, it was only recently launched, and so far it's generated a lot of media and quite a lot of discussion, and certainly raising, you know, public awareness about the issue, and we'll see what happens as it gets rolled out.
Now, I can imagine a couple of objections that people might have to this. One, among people who have been paying their student loans, they say, you find this also with mortgages, people resisting any kind of mortgage write-down proposals, saying, I've been paying my mortgage, so why should these chumps get a free ride? What would you respond to somebody who had that complaint?
Well, someone has likened that to someone who's been mugged being criticized for others who haven't been mugged. And in addition, there's a lot of debtors who have paid a goodly portion of their debts and are in the position of, you know, still having debts that are unpayable. I mean, the basic horizon here is that currently there is a massive amount of debt that is unpayable. And when debts are unpayable, something should be done about that. And what we invoke is this long tradition of the debt jubilee, whereby, you know, going back to antiquity, Mesopotamia, and so on and so forth, ruling dynasties would recognize when they came into power that that debt slavery and debt bondage were corrosive of society, and that debt should be wiped out in one fell swoop. And so there is the debt jubilee is an idea that circulates around Occupy, the Occupy movement in general. So we decided to build it into the campaign.
Another thing, I imagine a lot of people who are debtors themselves still feel guilty about it. They feel like some kind of, you know, Protestant ethic is still very powerful. And people feel like they gave their word and this is somehow defaulting on a promise.
Yes, exactly. There's an extraordinarily powerful element of moralism that is that's built into the idea of debt, especially in our society, I think, where the fundamentalism of contracts is very deeply ingrained. And also, you know, American consumer society is built on debt. It's the passport to a middle-class standard of living. But the fact is that if you, and I know you do, if one reads the business pages of our newspapers, you find language and stories every day that basically record and communicate how large amounts of debt are being written off, even as we speak. The debt that has been incurred by large financial institutions and some countries even. This happens daily, and yet for the student debtor, this is considered to be an unacceptable violation of the Protestant work ethic.
Well, American history has been, compared to other countries, rather indulgent on a lot of debts. Our bankruptcy laws have historically been relatively easy compared to the old world. But we seem to have departed from that. That indulgence to debtors now has been considerably hardened, it seems, in recent years.
Well, in the case of student debt in particular, it's been denied because a few years ago our federal government decided that that student debtors could not declare bankruptcy at all. There's a question. There's an issue whether that's constitutionally acceptable, even to single out a particular class of debtor in that way. But in general, I think what you're saying is true. And in the global scheme of things, it's a case of the chickens coming home to roost to some degree, because developing countries have been caught in a debt trap for many decades now, and in the last few years, this very issue, this very problem, is now on the laps in the backyard, in the front yard of the first world and the global north. So in some sense, it is like the chickens coming home to roost.
Okay, finally, people who are listening who are interested in maybe signing or just want to learn more, what should they do?
Well, very simply, go to our website, OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org. That's not Occupy Student Debt. That's another website. It's OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org. And you can either sign as a debtor. There's a faculty pledge of support. Also, you can sign as a faculty supporter of the refusers. And there's a non-debtor's pledge of support if you're neither of the above, that you can pledge to support the refusers. And there is other information and blogs on the site, too.
I think I have more than a few listeners who are college teachers, so is there something they could contribute to the effort?
Well, the college teachers can sign the either of the other two pledges, for sure. In addition, they can circulate information about the campaign to their unions and their other professional associations.
I was Andrew Ross, professor of American Studies at NYU and one of the organizers of the campaign to renounce student debt. The website, again, for more info is OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org, OccupyStudentDebtCampaign.org, and don't forget the campaign part. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to KPFA.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata, performed by Gidon Kremer and Martha Argerich. It's said that Lenin didn't want to listen to that piece because it made him feel too much tenderness towards the bourgeoisie. My next guest is Phil Matera, research director of Good Jobs First, a D.C.-based organization that promotes disclosure and accountability in economic development schemes. States hand out billions in tax breaks and other subsidies in the name of job creation, but how much, to whom, and to what effect? Here to address those questions, Phil Matera. Welcome, Phil. Even in better times, state and local governments have been very eager to hand out business subsidies in order to foster job development, but I guess there's a special interest now that we're in pretty tough times and jobs are scarce. What do we know about the kinds of programs that states offer? First of all, how much do we know about what states offer? Do they reveal much? I suppose it varies from state to state, but give us a national overview.
Well, it's estimated that states and localities spend about $70 billion a year on economic development subsidies. The, you know, these take various forms. These are corporate income tax credits. These are property tax abatements. They're exemptions on sales taxes that companies would otherwise have to pay. There are special zones like enterprise zones, which usually package a number of different tax breaks for investments in designated geographic areas. We also look at training programs where companies get reimbursed for the costs of training workers. We look at things like film tax credit or other film reimbursement programs because states are wild about attracting, you know, film projects, and they give these ridiculously generous subsidies to film production companies. And sometimes those are among the biggest in certain states.
Is it because they want to, the politicians want to hang out with starlets, or what's behind that?
That's part of it. they're really starstruck. And the film production companies take advantage of that. And they make it clear that, you know, if you give us these subsidies, you know, you have your picture taken with Brad Pitt or, you know, whoever is your favorite. And this is a problem because these programs are particularly ineffective at really promoting sustained, you know, economic development. But anyway, so those are another category. So there seems to be no end to the ways in which, you know, states and localities, you know, want to throw money at companies to try to get them to invest in, you know, their jurisdiction.
Now, how hard did you find it to put all this information together from state to state? I imagine you had to do a lot of digging 50 times over.
Yeah, and what we've been digging are several different things. You know, first there's the question of, well, how much do these programs cost in the aggregate? You know, what we found is, you know, it varies enormously, but there are, in some cases, it's just impossible to find out how much it costs. In our universe, and we have about 238 programs that we're examining in the 50 states and the District of Columbia, there are 20 of them where we just couldn't get any kind of cost estimate at all. So that's the first thing. How much do the programs cost in the aggregate? The second issue is which companies are getting the subsidies. And that was the focus of our previous report called Show Us the Subsidies, where we evaluated how transparent or not transparent the states are in this regard. And there's actually been some progress in that area, and we've taken advantage of that by creating a tool on our Good Jobs First website called Subsidy Tracker. You know, because these subsidies, even when they are disclosed, they're disclosed in very obscure places. So we've taken all the available information from all these sites, put it into one big searchable database that allows you to search across programs and across states. But then the other thing that we looked at most recently was what provisions these programs have to make sure that the recipients are, A, actually creating jobs with the subsidies they're receiving, and B, are they creating quality jobs? So we're looking at the provisions relating to job creation and wage and benefit requirements for those jobs.
Well, let's just take a closer look at some of the disclosures. What states stack up as particularly good and or bad? And the state I'm sitting in, New York, and the state where this broadcast originates, California, how do they stack up in particular?
Well, not so good, actually. California has disclosure really for only one of its major subsidy programs, which is called the Employment Training Panel, you know, which is a system by which employers get reimbursed for their training costs. But the state's other programs, the other major programs, for example, the Enterprise Zone program, which we know costs hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and there's no public disclosure of that. The film and TV tax credit is about $100 million a year. We don't know which film production companies are getting subsidies under that. And the big research and development tax credit is something written into the state tax code, which costs about $1 billion a year. We don't know which companies are claiming that credit and how much. California's pretty opaque. New York is a bit better, but not that much better.
And what about requirements? These states are free at handing out tax credits and other kinds of subsidies, but what do they require in return? Any kind of performance targets?
We just finished a report called Money for Something, which is a question as much as it is a statement, and which we're asking, you know, are states, you know, getting something for the money that they're giving out in subsidies? And we look at, again, at these same programs at the state level, and we ask two broad questions. One, do the programs have provisions in them that explicitly require the companies to create a certain number of jobs or to train a certain number of workers, you know, something like that? Or do they have other requirements such as that the company invest a certain amount of money in the state? And now we give more points, and, you know, we have our own little scoring system. We give more points to those programs that have requirements relating to job creation rather than investment, because we feel like, especially in the current economic climate, more jobs should be resulting from these subsidy awards. And, you know, as you know, sometimes when you invest, you can invest in a way that actually reduces employment if the things you invest in are kind of labor-saving equipment. So we don't think that simply requiring companies to invest is enough. They have to be required to create new jobs at the same time. And then the other major area we looked at in this new report is, do the states have requirements relating to what we call the job quality, which means minimum wage levels and minimum benefit requirements? Because the notion there is that if public money is being diverted to a private party, then there has to be some generalized economic benefit even beyond the creation of jobs, because we don't want public money being used to create substandard jobs. I mean, in the worst case, you know, some of those jobs may be so substandard that the workers have to rely on taxpayer-financed healthcare services and other safety net programs, so that the public, in effect, is paying twice. You know, it's paying, you know, for the tax credits, and then it's paying these, you know, for the cost of the safety net benefits. I mean, we have nothing against social safety net programs, but the workers in subsidized companies shouldn't be paying so little that they become eligible for them.
Yeah, I have an old friend of mine from college was running a public housing authority in Southern California and said, we exist to subsidize low-wage employment.
Right. I mean, and this, of course, is the Walmart problem. If you look at the data that's come out from numerous states on which employers account for the most workers or their dependents receiving Medicaid or the state children's health insurance program, you know, Walmart is almost always on the top of that list. Now, in part, that's because Walmart is the largest private employer, but it also reflects the, you know, the poor wages that Walmart is paying and the substandard health benefits it offers.
Speak with Phil Matera of Good Jobs First, based in Washington, D.C. All right, so how do the states score on this? Do many of them ask for anything in return for all of their largesse?
Well, it turns out that, you know, virtually all of the programs and all of the states have some kind of performance standard in their subsidy programs. But out of the 238 programs we looked at, only 135 have job-related requirements. In other words, job creation or training requirements that a certain number of workers be trained. So that means that 103 programs do not have those requirements, and those 103 programs have a total cost of more than $7 billion a year. So what that means is that, you know, the states are spending $7 billion a year on programs with no guarantee that they're going to result in any new jobs.
And what about wages? Are there any wage requirements?
Yeah, it's even more disappointing in that regard. Only about 106 of the 238 programs have either a wage or a benefit requirement. And the numbers actually look worse when you start to drill down. In terms of the wages, 98 of the programs have some kind of wage standard, but only 53 of those, a little more than half, have standards that are tied to a kind of a labor market rate rather than a fixed amount. I mean, we found a program in Delaware where the so-called wage standard was to pay $7 an hour. Well, of course, that's now less than the federal minimum wage, so that doesn't mean anything. And that's the problem with these fixed amount standards. They don't get updated regularly. So that's why we give more points in our scoring system to wage standards that are tied to something like the average wage in a geographic area or in an industry sector. You know, so ideally, the standard will say something like the employer must pay at least, 100% of the wage in a given county or in an industry group. Now, even that is not really good enough. I mean, what we would really like is standards that raise pay in subsidized companies above the market averages. And we only found 11 programs that do that, and 11 programs that have wage standards that are at least 105% of the average for the geographic area or the industry sector. So in other words, very few programs are really requiring subsidized employers to raise living standards above the current levels. And then finally, in the healthcare area, the results are also pretty disappointing. Only 51 of the programs require a subsidized employer to even make some kind of healthcare coverage available, and only 31 of those have requirements that the employer contribute to the premium costs. I think the conclusion of all this is that states may be getting something for their money, but they're certainly not getting enough for their money in terms of economic impact and improvements in living standards.
And although you did address this in these particular reports, this is the $64 billion question. Do these things work? Do these subsidy programs actually create jobs and a generalized prosperity?
Yeah, well, we weren't able to do a kind of a formal cost-benefit analysis or, kind of an effectiveness assessment for each one of these programs. And we also make the point that even if these safeguards and accountability measures are in place, that's no guarantee that the programs actually work. And there's plenty of anecdotal evidence of ineffective and unsuccessful programs. And in the end, it may be that some of these programs, or even many of these programs, just need to be eliminated entirely. I mean, even if you don't take the libertarian view that all these programs are an anathema, because they are interference in the marketplace, a lot of them really are, wastes of taxpayer money. And in fact, a number of states have been eliminating programs in recent years. Now, the problem is sometimes they eliminate programs and then they do other things which are not so desirable. For example, in Michigan, after Rick Snyder took office as governor, he said he was going to reform the subsidy system, and they're actually phasing out a number of the big subsidy programs. But at the same time, he's lowering tax rates across the board for all corporations in such a way that the lost revenue from that will outweigh any savings from eliminating the wasteful subsidy programs. So it's not clear that people in Michigan would be any better off after this process is over.
Well, now, having looked at a lot of these programs across the country, is there a right way to go about this? Could states actually stimulate job creation with reasonably effective programs?
Well, I think it's really an open question as to whether these company-specific subsidies really do the trick. I mean, we at Good Jobs First tend to focus more on economic development programs that, for example, invest in infrastructure that kind of benefits everybody rather than individual companies, or programs that train people. Now, whether there are jobs for them to be trained for is another question, but in theory, you know, training people, you know, does them some good. It really is unclear. And in fact, we don't point to any model programs and say, all right, here are the ones that are working and, you know, just follow this. And, you know, some of the programs that get a lot of attention, for example, the ones in Texas. So for some reason, you know, Rick Perry has promoted the idea that there's a Texas miracle and his programs have created a lot of new jobs. We don't see any evidence of that. The programs that they spend the most money on are seem to be pretty ineffective and kind of rife with cronyism and, you know, apparent corruption.
Rick Perry, I'm shocked to hear this.
Yes, sure. So we don't have a lot in the way of kind of positive examples. And part of the problem is that so much money is being thrown at companies, particularly when they get big subsidy packages. And this often happens, you know, particularly with those few big manufacturing projects that are left in the United States. You know, when one of the foreign automakers, you know, decides to open a plant, like when, you know, Volkswagen decided to open a plant in Tennessee a couple of years ago, you know, they got like $600 million, or the controversial Boeing plant in South Carolina, you know, was getting something like $900 million, or a ThyssenKrupp steel plant, you know, in Alabama is getting about $1 billion. I mean, there's no way that you could ever kind of make up for these enormous outlays. Now, you know, I mean, sometimes they do create jobs, but in strict cost-benefit terms, it's not clear that the number of jobs that are created can ever outweigh these enormous outlays and losses of tax revenue.
Well, as I recall from what I've read of the business location literature, what drives businesses deciding where and how much to invest is infrastructure, labor force, proximity to markets, things like that, and taxes and subsidies are actually pretty far down the list. Is that your impression?
That's true, and that's what's so galling about this whole process, that there's no indication that these deals are actually decisive in getting companies to decide where to locate. But there's no doubt that companies will take advantage of the desperation of public officials for giving the appearance, at least, that they're creating new jobs. So that, you know, once they've decided on a location, they have no compunction about kind of setting up these phony competitions among different states to get the localities to bid against one another. And so even though they've already decided where they're going to go, they make it sound like they're still deciding, so that the place they've chosen ends up, you know, giving away all these subsidies really for no reason. But they don't know that. I guess this is the prisoner's dilemma sort of situation. But the other situation that comes up a lot is when companies make demands for job retention deals. That is, they want subsidies not because they're building a new facility, but they want subsidies for an existing facility, and to, you know, they claim that they're going to move out of state unless they get a deal. You know, these are kind of extortion rackets. And
well, it's also, I mean, it's almost like a game theory thing, because the, you said prisoner's dilemma earlier, but what's not rational for the system as a whole, an individual politician or state caught in this this gun-to-the-head bargaining tactic has little choice but to go along.
Yeah, right. I mean, we see this also with stadiums, I mean, which is, you know, perhaps one of the most egregious ways of, egregious forms of subsidy abuse. You know, where the owners of these, you know, very lucrative sports teams, you know, manage to essentially get their facilities paid for, often in full. I mean, you know, they are more successful at this game often than companies in the manufacturing sector, you know, which rarely get 100% of their construction costs paid for. But it's not unusual for that to happen with stadiums and the economic impact of these stadiums. I mean, particularly in football, where the number of games per year played in these stadiums is tiny, yet local officials are willing to divert huge amounts of public revenue into these things. You know, of course, they argue that, well, it's part of the identity of the city, and it'll be a severe blow. I mean, they're all still trying to recover from the trauma that Brooklyn faced, you know, when the Dodgers left, you know, more than 50 years ago.
Well, we got the Nets now, so everything's all right.
Oh, right.
That was Phil Matera, Research Director of Good Jobs First, a Washington-based organization that promotes disclosure and accountability in economic development programs. For more, including the reports that Phil mentioned, visit their website at goodjobsfirst.org, goodjobsfirst.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 30, one of the glories of human creation, in honor of the 241st anniversary of his birth. It was performed by Andras Schiff. Till next week, bye.